Okay. Well, are we just going to start right off with what's fueling this podcast, or should I do a proper intro?
Well,
I like it when we just kind of fumble into the beginning of an episode.
Sure, no.
Or should I do?
Welcome back to Switchcast. Switchcast is hosted by your host, me, Doug Tabbitt, and your other host, him,
Hello.
Tyler Sanders. Not him, like him in Smokey and the Bandit. Nope, Cannonball Run, sorry.
Yeah, no. It's Bert, just me. Hi, guys.
Bert Reynolds movies. Anyway, Tyler Sanders, and brought to you electronically through some wires and cables and
dongles.
Internet dongles and all that stuff by our producer, Ethan Huffnagel, who does a bang-up job, as they say, somewhere else, not here, but I just said it, so... as we say, I guess. Switchcast is a podcast where we know what we're talking about despite evidence to the contrary.
I think that's my favorite tagline of ours.
We've never been convicted, though. We've been tried.
Oh,
okay. Don't know by whom or how, but...
we try really hard.
Nah.
Oh, okay.
All right. All right. what's fueling this podcast?
Whoo, thankfully. Nice segue. I've got... some Christmas whiskey. This was a gift from the in-laws. This is some holiday soft red wheat six-year bourbon. I'm excited to continue drinking.
I've got to pour it on mic.
Uh-oh.
Here, I'll help you out. I'll pour. Whoa!
Oh, no.
That is not large enough to. we had an accident here. Okay.
Thankfully, corks work.
The one audio podcast exclusive feature that we do here on Switchcast
is the pouring and the uncorking.
it's my favorite part. I hope it comes through as impressively as
how is that wine
it does in my mind.
Is the wine a good time?
The wine is a great time, yes. So I am reusing our fuel from last episode, Cabernet Sauvignon by Grand Napa Vineyards. Their 2021 Reserve.
Delicious.
Very good. Very smooth. Yes.
You got some tannins in there?
No, not many. No, it's nice. It's not going to give me a headache later on or tomorrow.
Yes.
Which a lot of red wine does. So that's why I like that boxed white wine now as I get old.
Boxed white. I'm going to cruise right past that. We can talk about that later. You have been teasing.
The other thing we're going to talk about later... for our patrons only, is our paid car reviewers legit or unfairly biased? Yes.
But I want to know, Doug, the answer to that question, first of all, so I would be subscribed on Patreon. But you had something, some data, some money thing you wanted to rant about.
So,
and you have been teasing Ethan and I all night.
Also only for our patrons and audio listeners, is our warm-up lap, because before you go off to the races, you've got to get all your fluids warmed up, your tires, your brakes, etc., so they function properly. Well, this rant is going to be the equivalent of me going out on my outlap and drifting the car, because I am fired up already about this. And it is car-related. I'll explain why you may not understand in the first 5 to 10 minutes, but I promise you will get there. We will get there. I was listening to or watching a Dave Ramsey highlight on YouTube, and somebody called in who had purchased a whole life or universal life, basically the same thing, policy for their kid, and essentially was arguing with Dave, wanted to say, well, Dave, you're all wrong about whole life, because Dave Ramsey, for those of you who don't know, is a financial guru. Guru is kind of the wrong word, because that implies that he's like got a Ponzi scheme thing. But anyway, he's a talk show host. You obviously know who he is. There's 2 million podcasts and he's rated number 2 in the world, and we're like number 1,900,000, whatever. So I don't know why.
But we're on the same list, Doug.
Who Dave Ramsey is. The nobody saying, hey, have you heard of this guy? Okay. Anyway, I enjoy personal finance. I enjoy learning about that stuff. I used to have a whole life policy. I cashed it in when I learned the amazing detail the cash value, right? The thing that you're paying into, the thing that is gaining a return, your quote unquote investment, the investment part of this two-headed monster where they put life insurance and investing together and try to package it and say it's better than just life insurance and an investment. Right. It's like the Audi S5 of cars, right? It's not a good sports car and it's not a good daily driver, but it's mediocre at both. So it's this great middle ground. No, just buy a real sports car and buy a real day. Anyway. Okay. So I was trying to argue with Dave about why Whole Life is such a great deal. Cause Dave is just like completely anti Whole Life. They're ripoffs. The people selling them are the only people that believe in them. There's no real financial advisors that think they're a good deal except the ones that sell them.
Okay.
And I have debated some financial advisors about Whole Life policies, and they stand by them on three main principles. One, the life insurance is not taxable, right? So if you have an inherited IRA, you will pay tax on it. Okay, valid point. But if you put your money into a Roth, it's not taxable. And real estate inherited is also not taxable. So like, it's not the best argument in the world.
Like, because there are other avenues to do a non-taxable sort of like inheritance kind of thing.
And then they're like, well, if you don't get to do the Roth thing, not everybody's financially savvy or whatever. And I'm like, well, but that's like saying because you invested poorly in order to avoid taxes, you should do this. Like it's not a fair argument regardless. Okay. So that's the one thing. The second one is, well, it's also life insurance. So I learned that the cash value, the investment that you put in dies with you. So when you die, the life insurance company gets that money. All that you've been putting into, all that growth goes away. But then they move the cup over here and say, well, but you get the death benefit, the quote unquote life insurance.
Well,
but that's a life insurance policy. I've been saving and putting money into this quote unquote investment, investing money for the life insurance company that sold it to me.
This is a wild scam that whoever came up with this is a genius.
Oh, but no.
Piece of garbage, but a genius.
No, but you can borrow against it. You're borrowing from yourself.
Well, like, I don't want to skip over the fact that I don't know any of these numbers, but I'm guessing if you did this, what they would call the quote unquote correct way is the money that you have invested then has grown is a larger amount than the life insurance benefit, correct?
Yes.
Most of the time, very possible.
Most of the time, probably all the time. And the commissions that go to the people selling it are massive. So I actually looked at a amortization schedule, essentially. When somebody was trying to sell me one and they, you know, they do like a car dealer, they go, well, how much can you afford to contribute? So they put it on you.
Yeah.
And so they're like, if you could do $1,000 a month, here's what your investment will look like 20 years from now. Now, there's a key thing. You can't go online and just get a calculator because the numbers are so bad. You can't go online and just be like, how much should my whole life insurance cost? But if you only pay the premium for whole life versus term life, now, they'll argue, well, whole life is permanent. Once you're paid up in the policy, it's there for good. That's another one of their arguments, whereas term life is only for a certain amount of time. And whole life, well, if you have health issues or whatever, you can convert a term to a whole life and you're still rated at the same health rating. So, like, you can have permanent life insurance. That's probably the only maybe positive of it. But if you're, again, if you're doing things right, after 30 years of your term, fixed term life insurance policy, you should be self-insured. Your kids should be grown up. You shouldn't need life insurance after 30, 40 years of being an adult. So,
okay.
Anyway, if you strictly, if you don't do the investment portion of it, you don't care about the cash value and you only are buying it for the life insurance, it is, according to any place online, 15 times more expensive than a comparable term life policy.
Oh.
15 times more expensive.
Holy moly. Well, I guess we know where the commissions come from.
Right. That's just for the life insurance portion. That's not if, like, oh, you're also putting money into the investment. Well, if I put $1,000 a month into this investment, after X number of years, they showed me this big number out here. after the first year, guess how much my $12,000 contribution would be?
Oh, okay. No.
Approximately $1,000. $11,000 was commissions. Huh. So not only are they robbing me blind, they're robbing me of all that future value, because the early contributions are the most important contributions in any investment because of the compound growth.
Yeah. Holy moly.
Right. Holy moly. So let's go back to this call. And the reason I want to talk about it here.
Well, is this eventually, Doug? I don't want to get ahead of you. How does this relate to cars?
You'll find out.
Okay.
You'll find out. We're on like lap three now. It's just, okay.
We don't even need any more segments. This is just the rest of the podcast.
No. Okay. So the reason I wanted to talk about this is because the guy called in and Ramsey had all of his usual arguments against whole life, but he never whipped out the investment calculator and just owned the guy with numbers. So here's the numbers of the guy who called. So he started investing when his kid was born. And he bought this policy. It was $5,700 a year he would contribute until he was 13. And then the policy was fully paid up. And the death benefit or the cash value essentially would be like $2.5 or $2 million when he was 88 years old, his kid. And Dave says, well, but that dies with you. And he goes, well, no, it doesn't, because they reinvest something. But it's not reinvestment. It's the dividends that are paid to you, which you should put in your pocket from this policy. They use that to repurchase more insurance, which is them saying, oh, your cash value doesn't die with you, but it still does. You're just paying them an extra premium for it not to. So you're just rebuying the insurance all over. So the money you put in that should be your growth that becomes theirs, you're then paying them more money to get back. Regardless, the death benefit, which is the quote-unquote life insurance, from the $70,000 that he put in from age 1 to 13 is $2.5 million. So the guy's going, oh, well, he's fully paid up. He's got this $2.5 million death benefit. Like, we're good. Like, why would I not do that? And he can borrow against it during the course of his life, which that you shouldn't borrow against investments. And that's what a friggin' savings account is, right? So they're defining it as a life insurance policy and an investment and a savings account, whatever. Okay. The numbers. This is staggering. $70,000 at age 13. And he's bragging and saying that why he should do this, because he'll have $2.5 million at age 88.
Well, and this also, and I think this is probably where you're going, that amount of money sounded similar enough to the contribution limit for a Roth IRA, where you could
Correct.
Put this money anyway. And I don't know how old
totally
you have to
tax-free.
Be
tax-free
to invest. Can you open a Roth IRA for like a child?
No, but you, yeah, they have to have okay. earned income, but you could open up different investment accounts, or you could just open one up and then give it to them
gotcha.
As part of like your advanced estate, and you can transfer it to them tax free. Okay. So you just like
that
wouldn't
would
put
dope.
It in their name.
So you would contribute to a Roth IRA and eventually transfer it
and
to
just
some
give
legal
it to
thing
them.
From. Okay.
Yes.
That's
and you can
notes.
Do it tax free based on the unified estate tax credit or whatever. So it's basically like a pre-inheritance.
Okay.
So, okay. $70,000 at age 13, $2.5 million at age 88.
Uh-huh.
So that's 75 years of growth. If we're using the average annual rate of return of S&P 500 index fund, Dow Jones index fund, so no like magic, no just throw it in an index fund, 10% annually.
Oh, Ethan is upset about this.
Do you want me to use 9%?
No.
Here, we'll do
9%. I didn't mean that. No, 10's fine. I think that's what they use on, I think they actually use 11 on Ramsey.
Right.
So 10%
so
seems
being,
good.
I'm being more conservative.
Sure.
Okay. This is past performance. You can't argue with that. That's what the stock
market has done. I'm not
saying you. I'm saying you.
Tyler threw me under the bus
you,
for
everyone
no
else.
Just now.
You made a
right?
noise.
So,
okay, well, the life insurance isn't taxable. You can borrow against it. All these perks. $2.5 million from a $70,000 investment. If you put it in the friggin' index fund, it would be $89 million.
Woo!
$89 million. That is how much the friggin' whole life companies are robbing you. And when my buddy tried to sell me whole life, he was talking about how New York Life was like, you know, this big building, they have billions in assets. They're so financially secure. And I'm like, I know why, because they're investing his 70 grand and they're making the 10% return. And they made $89,000 off of this sucker. And then they paid him a measly $2.5 million if he still even had the policy by that time.
Oh, they made 89 million. You said 1,000, but yeah. So they made 89 million. They gave him a measly 2.5.
2.5%. Here's the crazy thing.
That's wild. Okay.
So if he had instead put, if he had started, so that's if he just at his kid's 13, he's like, well, screw this policy. I'm going to take my cash value while I still can and put it in the stock market. Is his $70,000 would be 89 million instead of 2.5%. So you can make any argument about borrowing against it, tax shelters, whatever. I'll pay all the taxes on 89 million bucks for that. I don't care. If instead he had straight up just started investing the $5,700 a year into the same investment, because that growth compounds as he's investing, he would have $151,968 at age 13. That, because of the early growth, that compounds at age 88 to $193 million. And the rounding error, the $287,000 is more than you initially contributed. Your interest, your growth is $193 million of the $193 million.
So I think
that's
kids,
what the whole life insurance policy costs you, people. You can make any argument in the world about all the gyrations you can do with it in infinity banking, $193 million.
Well, I just think it just goes to show that you cannot argue with compound interest.
Whole life salesman can.
But I think you need, like, of course, because they shower you with all these other potential benefits and yada yada. But it's like, when it comes down to it, there is nothing more powerful than compound interest. And in order to take advantage of compound interest, you need to contribute as early as possible and not to.
You know how this is car related?
Yeah.
Guess
yeah, yeah.
How many how McLaren is- F1s I could buy with $193 million? You know how many I can buy with $2.5 million? Zero. I can buy zero McLarens with a whole life policy contributing $70,000.
I love that's how it's car related. I love that.
Beautiful. Bravo. Can this just be the Patreon segment? Like, that was amazing. Oh, gosh. No notes. No notes.
When you see that kind of financial injustice, it burns into your brain. The numbers just sit there and you go, what the heck? What the heck? I have friends that are fully, that sell this stuff, that fully believe in it. And I'm like, but the calculator, the calculator doesn't lie. Well that's if you invest perfectly. I'm like,
no, it's, if no, you use it's an
the
index
same
fund.
Amount of money. It's, we're giving it to you. Or an index fund.
Why is, maybe I just missed this. Why are we going to age 88?
Because that, I'm using the scenario of the caller. Because he set the numbers. Got his it. Scenario was, I contributed $5,700 a year from age whatever to age 13. He said it was a $70,000 total contribution to pay up the policy. At age 88, it would be $2.5 million. Like, that was the scenario he was using. Okay. So I just duplicated scenario. So there's no, oh, well, you changed it by this amount, whatever. Like, that was.
Yeah, okay.
$193 million.
That just goes to show that's why they can have these massive headquarters and get people bought in, and why they can pay huge commissions. I wouldn't be surprised if the folks selling them believe in it because they get a crap load of money for.
I would like to believe the people I know that sell it. I would like to believe better of them, but I either have to believe that they haven't sat down with a calculator or they are biased.
Because I do,
because of the commissions,
and it's not just because of the pile of potential McLaren F1s that could be in front of us. It's like, if you pull out the calculator, there is no reason for that to exist at all. It doesn't make sense.
It's legalized theft. It really is. I would be fine with whole life existing purely as insurance, because for people who have medical conditions that prohibit them from obtaining regular life insurance or have aged out of it, you know, like, well, it's too expensive to get term, or I can't get approved for term, or whatever situation, like even Ramsey says 99% of the time term is better than whole. There is a 1%. He's not an absolutist from a purely insurance perspective, but is only as insurance, not as an investment.
I also feel like it's so odd. It feels so oddly dystopian to link together insurance and investments to me. Like, I don't know. There's a whole lot of, I feel are
investing just... properly is the best insurance you can have.
Bingo. All right, Ethan, turn on those cameras. Let's roll.
No, there isn't.
No, see, I was setting up. I was setting up Ethan for an
argument.
No, I was setting up Ethan for an argument.
No. I cannot. Yeah. Term life, hands down, makes the most sense. Universal life, whole life, whatever. There's other. Yeah. 100%. I think the implications of investing and compounding interest are where folks like Ramsey or other astute financial advisors kind of, there's nuances there, and they take different stances on, is it your income is your most powerful wealth building tool? Is it time compounding interest? Is that your most? So that's what I meant when I said that, not about term life or universal or whole life or whatever. I agree. Term life is the way to go. Just on the record.
Sure.
Stating that.
Well, and investing regularly is the way to go. No yes. matter where the source is.
Always be buying. Can I get an amen?
Yes, amen. Time in the market beats timing the market.
So you want to maximize your time in the market.
Correct.
For compounding interest.
Yeah, I just like voting for Democrats. Do it early and often.
Ethan, I'm giving you magazines of ammunition over here, my guy.
I'm just talking over you so he can't. There's no...
is a future Patreon segment, maybe.
Bandoliers.
Oh, man. This was our dinner debate. You might have thought it would never happen, but Switchcast is endorsing a transport company. Whether you're moving a rare collectible, a high-end sports car, or your personal luxury vehicle, Shaughnessy Overland Express delivers with precision, privacy, and respect. This isn't just transport, it's white glove care from pickup to delivery. For over 14 years, they've earned the trust of collectors, enthusiasts, dealers, and owners by offering unmatched service and personalized attention. You'll work directly with their experienced in-house team, ensuring a smooth and private experience without middlemen or surprises. Every shipment is protected with up to $3 million in cargo insurance, offering peace of mind for even the most valuable and rare vehicles on the road. In addition to their enclosed fleet, they've also established a trusted auto transport brokerage service, giving you access to a nationwide network of vetted open and enclosed carriers. Whether you need transport on a route they don't currently operate or their carriers are at full capacity when your schedule demands, they'll still get it done without compromising the Shaughnessy standard of excellence. Same professionalism, same personal touch, expanded flexibility. We are proud at Switchcast to endorse Shaughnessy Overland Express as the official transporter of Switchcast. Visit SOEXinc.com and tell them Switchcast sent you. . 2025 is over, and hindsight is 2020, and as we said in 2021, 2020 is hindsight. That was the best year to be in hindsight ever. 2025, there's been no pandemics and no major market happenings. Everything in the U.S. has pretty much been going gangbusters from an economic perspective, and especially in the world of cars. Collector cars seem to just get more and more collectible, at least in certain segments. In other segments, they have kind of returned to normal. Normalcy, prices have come down, demand has come down a little bit, but overall, generally predictable.
Well, and I think we have seen kind of what you and I thought was going, and pff, my opinion, who cares, but like more so of what we've talked about a lot of is, you know, there will be a correction, there will be a settling, but it's not going back to what it was in 2019. And when you look at, you know, I love using classic.com to see some history for as much as at least the free, you know, access will give you. And you pretty much every car you look at, it's a wall in like 2020, 2021. And it's come down, but it's like not anywhere close to where
the wall
started.
But there's a few walls or hockey sticks happening this year as well. So we wanted to pick out some of the best and worst auction results of 2025, or at least our highlights. This is not a comprehensive market analysis. This is just what were the deals? What are the winners and losers of the year? What were the ones that we that stuck out to us watching over the year? And there's a lot of them because the number of auction companies out there seems to be increasing despite our predictions. DuPont Registry Live is now a thing.
I just started getting emails from them and I don't know how. It's like every morning it's like, hey, new auctions. And I'm like, cool, but when did I sign up for this? I don't understand.
Probably from Wholesale Car Club. But anyway, yeah, there's so many auctions in the high-end space that it makes it very difficult to even like keep track of everything that's going on, let alone like pick out highlights, because they're just they're everywhere. I literally had been emailed a 360 Challenge Stradale, and then I couldn't figure out which auction platform it was on because I had deleted the email. And I'm like, shoot, I need to find that listing. And I went through like five of them and couldn't find it. And it was the seventh one. You know, there's too many. There at least needs to be an MLS for this stuff that you can go to one centralized source and at least find out where that car is being listed. Classic.com might say that they're doing that, but the problem is
close.
Well, no, they're not, though. They could be, but they are charging people in order to list your cars on there.
Oh, really?
So to push your data to them, you have to pay them, and you have to pay. And this is the one thing I had beef with them when they wanted me to pay to list my cars on there. And I'm like, well, but are you a data company or are you a listing company? Like, I can't be both the customer and the product.
Yeah, that's a
So anyway, let's look at the standouts. The spiciest results, you'll get my joke in a second. I made the punchline first, are the green Porsche Cayennes on Cars and Bids, and not just one. There was two 2014 jet green metallic 6-speed manual Cayennes that sold on Cars and Bids this year.
There was a second? Holy moly.
The
this
second
for
one
70.
Is described as rare, but maybe they aren't so rare. The first one kind of broke the internet. It had a not super low 64,000 miles. Oh, shoot. There's a TBR Tuscan Speed 6 on here right now. Sorry, guys. Squirrel. The most beautiful, unreliable car that I really shouldn't ever own, but I kind of want. It's my guilty pleasure car. Okay. It sold for a eye-watering, record-breaking $125,500. And they did confirm that this was an actual transaction. Money was wired. This is a real deal. Just because it was 6-speed manual and green. Absolutely mind-blowing. Well, if that wasn't enough, they sold a second one, 82,000 miles. Photos weren't quite as good. It went for a paltry $70,000 compared to the other one, but that's still an eye-watering number.
That is a staggering amount of money.
And you know what? I've driven a manual Cayenne, and it didn't excite me that much.
I don't.
Some cars are better as automatics.
And this is something I've learned. So I have a manual Volvo V50. It's got the 5-cylinder. It's got all-wheel drive. It's nice. And I like that it has a manual. But I went down when I first bought it this like rabbit hole of what mods do I want, yada, yada. And I realized like it's a daily. I just want it to work. And I like having a manual daily, but it's not a sports car.
But it has to be the right platform, too. It's not just about, do I want to shift on a daily basis? It's, do I want to shift this type of vehicle? I had a 5-speed manual Ford F-350 Super Duty, and I'm like, this is so cool. I'm such a stick nerd because I got one of these. It was terrible. It was terrible. An automatic is way better in that car. It has nothing to do with hills. It has nothing to do with anything other than I don't want to shift that thing. It's not fun, engaging, good, whatever. All right, Tyler, what's one of your standouts?
So unfortunately for our friend Dan, it seems that really good spec Aston V8 Vantages have gone more than I have expected. So a couple of these have gone for over $50,000, and that seems, now you can correct me because I'm not like super into this. That seems like a staggering amount of money for
that's
one
a
of
lot
these.
For a 4.3.
And that's like, I think all of these are early 4.3s. Like the one I'm looking at now is, you know, black with an awesome, like kind of brownish tan interior. Another one was green over green. So they're like awesome specs. And a lot of the normal ones go for like mid 30s. But it seems like if you want a special one, if you want a good spec and a good color, these are beginning to do the creeping up thing.
This isn't auction related, but bone to pick with Dan too, because he's not here. Deal of the year. It wasn't that crazy of a deal, but for the spec it was. As Dan's looking for an Aston Martin V8 Vantage, he sent me a blue over red Roadster that was listed at like a GMC dealer in North Carolina. And this was 11 p.m. And I tried, you can actually buy it online. You can do all the legal paperwork and everything.
Really?
I tried to go through the process and it glitched out just to be like, well, maybe somebody has a deposit, but I'll get the contract signed. Well, called them in the morning. It was already sold, as I figured it would be. It had been listed for 3 days. So it had 20,000 miles. It was listed for $40,000. And not only was it blue over red, but thanks to Dan's amazing database, it was a Tour de France blue Ferrari color, like to sample with Chancellor red interior.
That's hot.
It is hot. And Dan's like, oh yeah, I forgot that that's like your unicorn color and you wanted a Roadster.
Oh,
I'm like,
no.
Dan, you for what? I was literally going to pull the, I'm just going to wire money and then be like, hey babe, I bought an Aston Martin. Hope you're okay with that type of thing. That was one of the deals of the year. I was very, very bummed. I didn't find out about that sooner, Dan. He's sick, not here tonight. Our technical advisor technically failed me.
He didn't advise very well.
Mm.
But no, I think it's interesting because a lot of people say that these are super slept on cars for the experience you get for the amount of money. So it seems like there might be a separation happening in the market ever so slightly of like really hot specs.
Yep.
Between like a silver over black.
That is maybe the last 2 years summed up, though, is specs.
That's true. Win. Specs are king.
BMW M Roadster. This was what I thought was a really good deal. Fairly recent result. And it's not way, way under market for M Roadsters. It is a deal. 13,000 mile, 2000 BMW M Roadster. So it's the S52. So not as desirable, but just an amazing car to drive. Clean history. Low miles, clean car, well presented. It sold for $22,750 on Bring a Trailer a few days ago. And I'm going, wait a minute, S2000s are like $35,000 to $40,000 for a similarly low mileage car. So you can get a real analog M car inline six versus the VTEC four cylinder in the S2000.
Yeah.
I mean, I love S2000s, but for $15,000 less, you get a primo M Roadster like that or an S2000. It made S2000s look so overpriced when I saw that sell. I'm like, that's
insane.
It's just so much car for the money.
Well, and S2000s have just entirely like, you know, they've never made another one. It's supposed to be very reliable, very engaging, the sports car guy thing. But like they've seriously gotten like questionably expensive. For my taste.
Yep.
Obviously, I was very focused on 996 GT3s this year. I want to call back real quick to that terrible Track Rat Guards Red car that like just couldn't sell, and I don't actually know where it went. But, you know, I thought that watching this unfold this year was hilarious to me. It went on BAT, didn't sell, went to P-Car Market, no sale to 37,000. People offered up to like 50, still didn't sell. I don't know where it is, but it looks like a piece of crap.
Yep. I think it sold for less on P-Car Market than the high bid was on Bring a Trailer.
So it
very
was
shady.
Because we had talked about how, you know, not always going to the next auction site, that's not always a good idea. And mm-hmm. that failed in that case.
And not all bidding is legitimate bidding.
Yes. One that I thought was cool, though, and this was on Bring a Trailer. It was out of Belgium. It was a 996 GT3 Road Challenge. Have you heard of this, Doug?
A road challenge?
Road challenge car.
No.
So there was supposed to be this rally series in Belgium called Road Challenge, and Porsche built 10 996 GT3s based on the RS that are essentially rally cars. They're not the ride height is not that much higher, but they've got skid plates, they've got a gutted interior. Like, it's this is a like factory built rally car for the specific series that never ran. This car had like 8,000 miles on it, you know, yada yada. I think it like bid to 95,000 euros. We can't import it into the US yet, but mark my words, in like 10 years, there's going to be a 000 article on these cars that is going to make them go gangbusters. And I think people just have like not really focused on some of these like weird offshoot.
Was it a 997?
No, it was a 996.
So less than 10 years, you could... Is it a Mark II?
Yeah, it's a Mark II. So in a few years, you could import it. And it's like Metzger rally, like the 996 and 7 rally cars are so cool. Like,
that's really...
That is like... Oh, it's like, I don't know. There's just something about those ripping around like a European countryside that really gets some juices flowing.
So you need a house in Europe so I can just buy one over there and hold it.
And just like, you know, rip it around. Oh, guys, they're so cool. They look sick.
That's neat.
And they're like, they're VIN'd from Porsche, so they're street legal because they had to be street legal to drive between the different, you know, stages of the rally. So this will be street legal in the U.S. when you can import it.
Well, even if it wasn't street legal, once it's 25 years old, like, people are importing 355 challenge cars and getting titles for them.
Oh, really?
So it's yeah.
Do those not have VINs?
I think they have chassis VINs, but they're not a standard format.
Oh, interesting.
But you take the paperwork with a bill of sale and a European registration or whatever and take it in and just hand it to the DMV clerk and be like, oh, it's more than 25 years old.
It's interesting to see this kind of stuff because I was just reading a 000 article on the SCRS from like the 70s, mm-hmm. no, the 80s.
80s.
And it's like, you know, they made 20 of these things. Most of them raced and were beat to hell and others weren't. Like, this is not the same thing. It's not, you know, an awesome air-cooled car, but it's this kind of thing is almost there and people are going to go nuts at some point eventually for something like this.
All right. Ferrari. Not only has Ferrari as a manufacturer outperformed nearly all of their competitors and just continuing to rake in profit and very, very good for them because the alternative is, well, looking at Aston Martin and Lotus and all the companies that are struggling and might not make new cars. So we love that for Ferrari, but also the pre-owned market has kind of been reset to new highs this year. At RM Sotheby's, there was a blue over tan, blue Sera over Crema, I'm sorry, 512 TR with less than 8,000 miles that absolutely just blew the 512 TR market out of the water. Sold for $775,000. Now, there's been no relevant results since then to see if this has actually changed the 512 TR market significantly or if it was just, as we said, you know, the spec thing. This was a premium specimen in a rare and desirable color combination. The blue fever is a very real thing in today's market. So that remains to be seen whether or not that reset the market. But a couple transactions that did reset the market is the V8. So one transaction in particular, silver 360 Challenge Stradale on Bring a Trailer with 4,500 miles, sold for a massive $603,000 in September, which just, I mean, that totally reset the market. There's not been any significant public sales since then, although there have been a lot of cars listed on the market at similarly high prices, some even into the sevens and eights that are now marked as sold. So we know that at the very least it's brought the market up. We don't have a ton of verifiable data points, but that has reset the market. And the Scuderia market seems to have instantly reacted to the CS market as the best cars on the planet were just over 400K earlier this year. And that's marked by, I found a 2009 Ferrari 430 Scuderia in Rosso Scuderia with 1,200 miles, factory stripe, and exposed carbon rockers. It was listed in February by Motor Car Classics for 430 grand. Well, now the worst examples on the market seem to be around that number, and the best are well into the fives and sixes. Again, not many publicly available data points, but the asking prices and the private transactions are up there. So, yeah, Ferrari's jumped big time in the last 3 to 6 months.
What I've also noticed, jumping considerably, now this is your typical cream puff delivery mile, is still in the shrink wrap kind of situation, but I've noticed Cobra Fox bodies have like kind of gone insane. So there's one that had like 12 miles on it. So this is like absolute, somebody bought this and chucked it in a, you know, a warehouse. Mm-hmm. Went for $204,000 for a Fox body in teal.
Not an R, a regular Cobra.
Just SVT Cobra. That is nutto money. It's okay. In the right color. It's, you know, there's a lot, I guess, if you want some preservation thing, because it literally still does have the plastic wrap on the seats. It's essentially new, but $200,000 for this is kind of nuts. And I've seen, like, I don't have any metrics for it, but I have noticed the Cobras and especially the Cobra R's have like really popped off for low mile, good spec kind of situations. Somebody in this bring a trailer listing, though, is very, very confident in the Fox body market, though, Doug. They say the Fox body will soon dominate car auctions and will be the most sought after automobile ever built. The Fox body will reign supreme for decades into the future. This same car, or one close to its condition wise, will hit the $500,000 mark and shortly thereafter will hit the $1 million mark.
I feel like ChatGPT wrote that.
Kind of sounds
like it's just aggregating every other commenter post auction. It's like, oh, these are slept on. They'll soon be a million. They'll soon be a million.
They say, all you haters better get one now. Otherwise, you'll have to sell your house to get one. Or you have to settle for a poster on your garage wall or a model. Or you'll just have to sit in a lawn chair and drool.
They're still going?
Yeah, yeah. It's a huge.
This is ChatGPT. Come on.
It's nuts. So some people are really, really confident. But I'm amazed at how expensive some of these Fox bodies have gotten.
That's, wow. Okay. Well, and you can't take that anywhere. You have to invite people over to look at it.
Yeah, it's in your living room or something. It's a piece of art instead of actually a car.
All right. When rare does not mean desirable, the Panos AIV Roadsters have really struggled to find their collector footing. Maybe for a number of reasons. I think they're cool. I have a nostalgic draw to them, but after owning 5 or 6 of them, I'm good.
It's hard to drive on the highway.
It's hard to drive anywhere. one of one copper bronze extreme car that was a custom color shifting paint. It is an awesome, awesome color.
This color is sick.
Was for sale on Facebook Marketplace in the Panos group. The guy was asking 50 grand. Which is a little strong. Normal color cars with the same miles go for high 30s. And it bid on Bring a Trailer to $29,250. So once again, rare in this case does not mean desirable. It sold, or it bid to a quarter of the price of a green Porsche family hauler.
Look, these things are really cool, but I did drive one on the highway once and that was a bad time.
Yeah. Yeah, so that was a big, big flop. Panos big Roadsters are still searching for their, for their market manipulator. Somebody's got to buy them all up and drive that market up. But first they have to explain to people what Panos Roadsters are, that they're not a prowler, and then make people care.
That last part, I think, is where the real difficulty is at. I think they're cool, but I have Midtown Madness nostalgia.
Speaking of blue over crema being a killer color combo, did I tell you about this TVR Tuscan Speed 6?
Are you drooling? Have you put in a bid yet, Doug?
No, it's already at 50 grand.
Woo! Spicy. Oh, yeah, it is here on my Cars and Bids tab. It's 16. This is, it's gorgeous, though.
All right. The overall market has been very strong this year for the auction companies. RM hit a record year selling over $1 billion worth of cars.
With a B?
Holy moly. With a B. As well as selling two incredible Le Mans race cars, the Mercedes for $51 million and the Le Mans winning Ferrari 250 LM for $35 million. So a couple of very big, significant sales there. Although the 250 LM was way less than I thought it would go for. It was a car that won Le Mans outright. I know everybody loves the 250 GTOs, but this is arguably more significant. It still has like its race patina. I mean, I think it was 63 Le Mans winning car. I thought that was a 50 plus million, maybe even $100 million car for what everything else is going for. So $35 million. I think that was the deal of the year. But people with that much money obviously know more than I do. I'm just a bench critic.
I think these look really cool, but it is less beautiful, I guess, than the GTO.
Yeah.
Maybe that had something to do with it.
Yep. Possibly. But, go ahead, Tyler.
An update on a very personal update from me. Earlier this year at the Broad Arrow auction at Airwater, my old 968 was on the auction block.
Yes.
I was thinking chopping block, but none of that happening. It went for pretty much the same amount. I think a couple grand more than it went for, when Switch Cars sold it on Bring a Trailer for me. But there was actually, a comment on the Bring a Trailer listing asking the winner, are they still enjoying the car? So they said they sold it at Airwater earlier this year. Great car and enjoyed their time with it. It's somewhere out on the West Coast right now, and they have replaced it with a 968 Club Sport in triple black, which I can't blame. I think that car with a little less weight would have been sick. Mm-hmm. So I think I understand the Club Sport draw. So hopefully somebody on the West Coast is enjoying my old 968. I miss it until I look at my spreadsheet telling me how much money I spent maintaining it, and then I'm good.
Speaking of maintenance, little teaser here, our next episode in a couple weeks, we will be discussing our annual breakdown of how much our cars cost us to own and drive this year.
Ooh.
And we'll be bringing our friend Dan Doucette in, who is a eclectic car collector and daily drives an Alpha. So that'll be a fun discussion.
Thankfully for us, I just squeaked in essentially an entire front suspension rebuild on my Volvo. So we're,
It
drives great, but it, driving an old car is sometimes expensive daily.
Let's see. So RM had a record year. SBX Cars, a Supercar Blondie auction website, claims a record breaking year of their own, according to their email, year in recap today. Although it seems that their record-breaking year is connected to not their overall sales, but a single record-breaking sale of a Ring Brothers Di Tommaso Pantera, which, whatever. That's marketing spin, in my opinion. This Ring Brothers car sold for more than any other Pantera at a public auction. It sold for $363,000. Although I feel like that's like selling a singer at an auction and being like, well, it's record breaking because it sold for any more than any stock Porsche 964 in history. Like, it's whatever. I'll let them have that win. SBX bragged about in their email 1.6 million auction views, which in the grand scheme of things is really not that much. They did not mention in said email total sales, sell-through rates, or any, in my opinion, relevant numbers other than that they are getting close to their 100th overall sale. I've been a little cynical, sarcastic, whatever, about SBX Cars and our yearly auction house recaps. I don't wish anyone to fail. I wish the best of any good business, anyone who sets out to do a good business. And it seems like there's plenty of space for competition in this market. I don't know, just the way they market stuff, I feel like is slightly misleading how they package things. We covered that last year too. So it's good fodder for making fun of them on the podcast. So why not?
Yes.
Tyler. You got any more?
I just got one more, and this isn't really a huge, there's no big market. If you made a trend, it would have like three dots on it. But this year there was I love when these cars come up, and I think Doug gets sad because they're always way more expensive than he wants to spend.
WZ8.
No, this is the like special, like customized Bondurant cars.
So the Cobra Vix.
The Cobra Vix. And there was Taurus SHO. There was a Taurus SHO that was white that came up on Bring a Trailer this year that was customized specifically for the racing school. It still had the livery on it. It was essentially a track car ready to go. And I'm never going to buy these. They're always more expensive than I would want to spend. But I just love that they exist. And I wish there were more of them. The fact that at one point in time, there was enough money behind this organization that Roush got involved to like build these custom cars specifically for their school is so cool. So it's cool to see them come onto the market and change hands a little bit because it's...
But not for $40,000.
Yeah, the Cobra Vic.
It's a Crown Vic.
It is still a Crown Vic.
With so a different 4.6
They've really
the regular
4.6. The Taurus SHO is not so much. This one went for like 10 grand, but it was a little scruffy. So...
What SHO out there isn't scruffy? There's not.
That's true.
You can't find me one.
That's true.
You can't find
They're
me
all
one.
Scruffy.
I don't. Please don't find me one.
Doug, I got to be honest. So every time I watch the Santa Claus, the first one, you know, Claus with an E, Tim Allen is driving a Taurus SHO with like winter tires, and it makes me want one.
I know.
Makes me want one bad.
I know. Speaking of BMW Z8s, there is a silver with red interior BMW Z8 on Bring a Trailer. I've been watching these like a hawk, and this was the standout deal of the year. It was around, I think it was 14,000 miles. Very, very clean car. Had Alpina wheels and the stock wheels. No issues in its history, and it hammered at $163,000.
And there've you been... didn't buy it. Why?
I hadn't decided that silver over red was an acceptable color because I can't own a silver car, but I think that's the right color in a Z8.
Wasn't there one when
there was
we
one
went
at,
to
at,
go
at Kasser Motor Group when we went to get your GT3?
Yes.
But it was like a 4,000 mile car, which I don't
was that
want.
The moment that you were
I
like,
think
yes,
it was because I saw a Topaz over Crema car in the flesh and was underwhelmed. And I saw the silver over red and I was like, that's good. That's the right color for that car. All right. Well, shrewd negotiator. This is a guy who messaged us on Instagram about an M5 that we had for sale. Very rare spec. And as a car dealer, anyone selling a car, but car dealers especially, will appreciate this. There is nothing sweeter as a car dealer than selling a car for the asking price right after someone like, asked to talk, I got to talk to my wife, or I got to do this, or I'll be back tomorrow, or especially in the internet world, gives you a non-genuine good luck with sale.
I don't think GLWS is genuine. There might be some on Bring a Trailer because people will be like, hey, nice car, GLWS, but like on Facebook, maybe they're all they got to be all sarcastic.
I think they are all sarcastic. So we had listed this thing for like 6 hours. We're getting just inundated with inquiries. He says, what's your bottom dollar on the G80? I said, we have 5 to 6 seriously interested parties. First person to complete a purchase will own the car.
He Seems said, reasonable.
At what number?
Well, the listing
okay,
price.
Well, since you couldn't infer from that there's a supply-demand disparity here, said, given the amount of interest, we are holding firm to the listed price. GLWS.
Nice.
I resisted the urge when we got the check for the full asking price like 3 days later from the first guy who gave us a deposit and had to turn away 5 other people from just like texting and be like, didn't need luck, sold it on. I was right. Some people.
Wonderful. Love it.
Soul and Spine wants everyone to have a higher quality of life. They specialize in non-surgical options for those who have been told that they need injections or surgery. They offer state-of-the-art techniques that help over 90% of patients become pain-free in just weeks. Starting with thorough medical history and comprehensive examination, you'll work one-on-one with Dr. Hoover to meet all your treatment goals. Their mission is to unleash your body's own healing potential to avoid drugs and surgery. Visit solonspine.com to learn more. Located in Solon, Ohio. So we've talked about auctions and how they've done, but how does a small market specialty used car dealer perform? We're going to pull back the curtain and show you Switch Cars numbers for the year. We talk about some of the different auction sites, and of course, we're yes. using the numbers they publish to us and only what we can glean from that, but I'm going to publish the numbers. So people always ask me, like, what's the most expensive car you sold? How many cars do you sell a month? And they're often impressed at the numbers that I think they should be underwhelmed by, and vice versa. here we go. If you want to know what a small market dealer actually does, we'll talk about it.
Well, and I think I like it when companies or groups will pull back the curtain a little bit and give us some numbers, because we're getting a look into kind of how Switch Cars functions. And to a lot of people online, it might just seem like, here's where you go to buy, you know, awesome Porsches and BMWs and other weird, you know, enthusiast cars. But like, here's how it actually
yes.
kind of works.
And that's the numbers I'm publishing, is kind of what matters. Let's see. So let's start with the cheapest car we sold.
Nice.
Only by $34. It was a squeaked by as a winner. 2013 Ford Fiesta, $3,466.
How did you get a Fiesta?
It was an old employee of ours actually really? Sold it to us. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I think we paid $1,000, but before you think we tripled our money on it, we put quite a bit into it for service. So we might have paid $1,500. I don't remember. But that was second only to a pretty janky matte gray Acura RSX that we wholesaled for $3,500.
Oh, man. We were talking about cars previously that are all just kind of really crusty at this point. RSXs are, used to be sweet, but they're all kind of not good now.
Yep. Most expensive car sold. This is the answer that always disappoints people, but there's a reason for that. The most expensive one we sold was a 2005 Ford GT at $588,000, and that was not only a good result, it was a good result for that car and for the seller, who did very well on that car, and it was just kind of good timing in the market, kind of hit the peak for the year. And my note on that, because I have to defend myself before, lest I feel ashamed that that's the most expensive car I sold. Despite brokering exotics for 20 years, the really expensive stuff is hard to make a deal on. There's a lot of people trying to get their fingers in the cookie jar on the high-end stuff. We were negotiating multiple seven-figure car deals, and they never materialized this year for any number of reasons. But it's fine, because we found our sweet spot. And I actually avoid the super high dollar cars for a number of reasons. So what is impressive to me internally is not, you know, oh, we sold this $2 million car, because typically the margins on that are quite small. But our overall bottom line and our reduced risk, because we've picked a niche that works well yep. for us. And that matters more to everyone, not out there, but in our organization. The oldest vehicle we sold was a 1958 Porsche Tractor.
Oh, nice.
Indeed. The our total sales, we sold 243 cars. We were gunning for 250 or 220 or 240, depending on who you ask, but really 250 was the goal. December, our volume was a bit off. Holiday stuff, I think, for everybody.
Yeah.
But anyway, so we didn't quite get there. Well, we're filming this on the 30th, so maybe tomorrow we can sell seven cars. $16 million was our overall gross revs on cars sold. Percentage of profitable deals. This is where I like to brag. 96.3% of cars sold were profitable. Last year was 200 cars overall at a 94% profitability rate. So even as we are growing in volume, we are getting better at what we do.
Well, and I feel like is almost the most important number, because in indicating the health of the business. Like, I know nothing about the car business, but this feels like a staggeringly high stat to me.
It's pretty good if I compare myself to other dealers. The percentage of consignment and brokered cars versus inventory, 58% of sales by dollar value were owned inventory, but That 58% accounted for 67% of our gross profit on cars sold. Our average days in stock. Now, we do not have a policy of when it reaches X days, we automatically wholesale it. Some dealers do, and that skews their numbers, their profitability numbers, but we do not have that blanket policy. But our average days in stock, and this is from the date funds went out to the date funds came in, not like how long they were listed. This is recon shipping everything. 51 is our average days in stock. That is a record low compared to 60 last year. 433 was our longest. It was a anniversary car from last year. It was a 2006 Aston Martin V8 Vantage, and this was really only due to service and reconditioning delays. We lost an employee along the line there, but that shouldn't have happened. That wasn't due to a breakdown in our process. That just happened. We're turning our money 7 times throughout the year, and we're selling nearly at 100% ratio of sales per listings on a monthly basis. So dealers will measure to themselves and say, like, well, if we have 30 cars listed, a good metric is that we turn 50% of that number. So we're selling 15 if we have 30 cars listed. We're nearly at 100% ratio.
Wow. Okay.
Factoring in the cars that we broker. So it's not a totally fair number, but pretty close to that. Wholesale versus retail percentage, 81% of cars sold were sold retail. The most number of cars sold to a single customer this year is 5. 5 to one guy. Yep.
Hey,
all of those were June to December too. I looked back
really?
And like didn't buy anything January to March or January to May. Yeah.
And you got an itch.
Yep. The longest boomerang for a single owner. So this is a car we sold and then it came back to us. Some people go, why? That's something wrong with it. I'm like, no, not usually. That's a good thing because our customers are loyal. 2005 Ferrari 430. We sold it in 2018 and it came back to us this year from the same client who had owned it the whole time. And we sold it in 3 phone calls.
Heck yeah.
Absolutely.
So this didn't even hit Instagram.
Correct. So if you ask me what the shortest time we had a car was, it's like a few minutes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Technically, the longest boomerang was a 2007 Cobalt Blue GT3 that we brokered back in 2008, and we did sell it again this year, but we had sold it 2 or 3 times in between 2008 and now. The shortest boomerang was a 2004 Porsche GT2.
Oh, no.
Within a week of delivery, the ink on the temp tag was still drying. The customer said, nope, done with it. Nothing wrong with the car. Just like he had always wanted one, thought he was going to love it, and it wasn't for him. But it worked out because we bought it right, and we sold it for more than he had paid for it.
Oh, okay.
So we had people fighting over that one.
How many miles did it take him to know that it...
Like 10?
Whoa!
Maybe he needed more, but I don't know. He makes decisions very quickly. That's the same customer that we sold 5 cars to.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So, and he was the 3 phone call that bought the 430. So, but he loves that one he got. He's like, this is amazing. Thank you so much. This is great. So it's just like, you almost never know. Let's see. I was trying to add up like the number of cars that we sold more than once this year. So that we sold multiple times within the year. And that was difficult because I kind of had to go through manually. There was no way to just do a quick report on that, but it was quite a few of them. So I kind of went with a different stat, which I think is a fun story. The maximum number of times the same car sold. Now, this was not always – this started in 2023. This didn't all happen this year. But it was a eruption green GT500. Common color on a Bronco, but not so common on GT500.
And this is the one that was on Facebook and where somebody was asking for like, what's a good price for this or whatever.
Yep. So we had brokered this car, I think from the original owner to a customer, another different customer of ours back in 2023. we then this year, or no, last year, sold it from him to a different local customer of ours. Mm. Then the original owner wanted it back. So we bought it back from the customer that we sold it to the second time and then sold it back to the original owner. That happened this year, but also this year he decided that he had missed it. You know, the nostalgia was stronger than, you know, the whatever. So he decided he didn't really want to keep it. So then we sold it for him again. So between 2023 and now, we sold it from the one guy to a different guy, from the second guy to the third guy, from the third guy back to the first guy, and then sold it again for the first guy. So 4 times,
holy
I think,
moly.
We sold the same car in the last 2 years. Twice to one guy.
Whew.
And the third guy who bought it almost bought it back again from the first guy. Because he's like, oh, I shouldn't have sold that car.
Goodness.
Yeah. So we had some fun at Switch Cars this year. Tyler, you had, I think, some questions. You wanted to know some stats.
So I know you guys deal a lot in Porsches and BMWs.
Mm-hmm.
Which one, I want to know, did you sell more Porsches or more BMWs this year?
The way that I do my spreadsheets, it is not easily sortable, but I did the quick math on Porsche 911s of all variants versus all BMW M cars.
Okay.
Because that's kind of, I didn't include Caymans or whatever, or non-M BMWs. And we sold more than 3 times the number of Porsche 911s than BMW
Ooh,
M cars.
Really?
Yes.
That's a bigger spread, that, or like a bigger difference than I thought.
Me too.
Wow.
Me too. But those are like our two bread and butter cars. So that's, you know.
Some of the best.
Yep.
Do you have anything that jumps to mind for like what was the easiest sale? Well, the easiest sale is probably that 430 that you had to make like 3 phone calls and it was yoink. There you go. But like, and when I ask this, it's not from a like, I want to make fun of a potential buyer, but in a negative way. You know, I think we have a lot of quirks as car people, but was there like a particularly difficult sale or difficult situation that you had to navigate
the
through?
The most difficult ones typically are the ones that don't happen.
Really?
The theme of, I think this year, maybe it's last year, the years always jumble together, is the people who are negotiating over weeks, sometimes months, and they want another $500 off a $200,000 car, or they want this, or they want that. And then somebody comes in and buys it. And we're like, hey, sorry, not sorry, but somebody easier came in and like,
yeah,
we agreed to numbers, and they get just unbelievably angry. Like, well, at what point did you, I think one guy said, did you lose the, you know, did you miss that my intent was to buy the car? And I was like, I didn't. I know you intended to buy it, but you didn't do the actions required to buy it.
Well, and if they, what's wild to me, this is kind of going back to a previous topic about deposits on cars. It's like if the intention was there, the deposit would have been like, things would have moved forward. And that's kind of what I was curious of, is like the people that make the biggest hullabaloo about all this and ask all these questions and want, you know, the $25 off or whatever, like, does it ever actually matter? And it seems like for the most part, those deals don't actually complete.
There is, and I want to be careful saying this because it's not how we operate, but there's just kind of a saying, I guess, in the car business, that the people that you make the most money off are the best customers, not for you, but they're actually the happiest, because the people who negotiate, and it's not because like they're just blissfully ignorant. They have no clue that you ripped them off. That's not how it is. It's just like, it's not a cause and effect. It's just these two things are correlated. The people who are trying to negotiate every last dime and squeeze everything out of it are coming into it from a perspective of, me and the car dealer are enemies.
Yes.
And the people who aren't doing that, especially in the high-end car world where you're buying fun and you're buying joy, not transportation, like when they just come in, they're like, I love that car. I'm okay with you making money. Your price is fair enough. What am I going to gain for $1,000 off?
Yeah.
Like, it's just a different mentality. It's not because they paid more. It's just, yeah. So,
well, and I think you probably get a lot of people who are buying their first real toy or, you know, achieving a dream, and they're used to dealing with the typical dealership that, you know, they are very adversarial with. And I think if anything, from my limited perspective, I think you guys have done a good job at being the, like, you know, obviously you're a business, you need to make money, but you're not really trying to rip anybody off. And you kind of, we seem to work with people and create a very positive environment of, like, you know, we don't need to fight about this.
That's the goal.
Which I appreciate from the outside.
That's the goal. Speaking of Switch Car, that brings us to the props and flops of the week.
There's always
by them.
Yes, and Switch Cars is the enthusiast dealership where we buy and sell cars that we like ourselves. So check out our handpicked inventory at switchcars.com and be sure to mention Switchcast for special pricing when available. You can find more information online at switchcars.com or come visit our showroom in Twinsburg, Ohio. Doug, what is the pick of the week from Switch Cars inventory?
The pick of the week is a 2015 Porsche Cayman GTS, and it's white over red, full Ooh. Carrera red natural leather. Really nice color combo, nicely optioned X73 sport suspension, deletion of Alcantara, so it's all the full leather interior.
Oh, I love the leather.
Yeah, it's very nice. Adaptive sport seats, so the extra bolsters and stuff. So you can find that on our website, 67980, with 28,000 miles in a PDK. Let's see. Our flop of the week. There's some videos out there on social media. It looked like the old Willow Springs racetrack, but an R34 GTR that was an ex-Japanese time attack car was destroyed on a racetrack.
Oh, I think this was at Laguna Seca.
While parked, was it? Maybe, because it was a WeatherTech track.
Yes.
Yeah, while it was parked, during a red flag, which, you know why they have red flags?
To stop things.
Yeah, for safety. For safety. It was hit by the forklift carrying tires with which to repair the tire wall. And it was hit hard. And
I have seen a video, and it is a very sad video to watch.
Indeed it is. Let's see, our prop of the week. Now, this may be a little bit premature, but our producer, Ethan, sent us a link that in apparently Europe, they are considering legislation to to have more strict vision tests for people past the age of 70 for drivers. Now, this is not quite what we were gunning for in terms of wanting them to actually take higher or to retake driving tests once they're past a certain age to determine their competency and their ability to, like, actually drive. But I think it's a step in the right direction. I think it is the right thing to do and is also compassionate at some point to say you should not be operating deadly machinery.
Because I think, you know, we talk all the time, this is something that is dangerous for the individual and others around them. I see it with my own eyeballs plenty that, you know, at some point I think there needs to be some limit. And hopefully the necessary infrastructure will exist to ensure that these folks can still get around to be where they need to be to get the things they need to get, be it the appointments or whatever they need to be at. But I do think that something needs to be done. And I'm glad that someone on this marble we live on is thinking about some action to kind of put some bounds around, you know, when you are still able and legally allowed to drive.
Yeah. I mean, I told a story a long time ago. My grandmother ran over her neighbor because she was backing up to say hi to him, and she backed into him. He was fine. But, like, it's one of those things.
Well,
like, maybe.
Yeah.
Let's look at this. Maybe you should get a chauffeur.
Ugh.
Love you, Grandma.
The Sheffield brand was recently revived by Jake Turkbus, an owner of an original Sheffield all-sport diver he received from his parents in 1970 when he was just 11, beginning his love of watches. As an adult, Jay used his extensive expertise in product development and marketing to revive the brand that started it all.
He set out to develop watches with a high level of quality and specification at a value price. His first effort, and a successful one, on July of 2023, was the debut of the Sheffield All-Sport Diver 1. It had the kind of build and movement that much more expensive watches use, and his debut price of $108 was equivalent to the $13 his parents paid in 1970. Since that debut, Sheffield has expanded to a wider range of automatics and chronos, many designed around vintage Sheffield dials of the 60s. The Sheffield well of clever and unique design remains his inspiration, as well as maintaining the goal of high quality, very affordable range of automatic and quartz watches. Sheffield watches, value on merit, not just price. I love mine, so get yours at sheffieldwatches.com and be sure to mention you found them on Switchcast.
Thank you for joining us for Switchcast with Doug Tabbitt and Tyler Sanders, produced by Ethan Huffnagel. Switchcast is an automotive entertainment and opinion show, and nothing we say should be taken very seriously. We do not give tax, investment, legal, emotional, or professional advice, and the only licenses we hold are driver's licenses. The opinions expressed on this show are exclusively held by the people pontificating at that moment and do not reflect the values of our producers or sponsors. Our theme music is provided by Emily and Ivory. You can stream their full album on Spotify or SoundCloud. If you like this show, you can stream it in its entirety on your favorite audio podcast platform. Check out switchcast.live for more info.